You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We're here tonight to honor and celebrate the poet Lew Welch, friend, mentor, teacher, who disappeared 40 years ago this week into the rugged Sierra foothills near Nevada City, California. We're going to read some of Lew's poems, tell you some stories about Lew and what he meant to us, and we'll hear Lew read a few poems himself, courtesy of the University of Pennsylvania Sound Archives. There are four readers tonight, including myself. Lewis McAdams is a poet, activist, and journalist, author of a dozen books of poetry, and founder of Friends of the LA River. April Fitzsimmons is a playwright and performer and in grad school at Antioch University, and she's currently working on a memoir biography of Lew Welch. And we are very honored to welcome Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gary Snyder, a longtime friend of Lew Welch, who joins us tonight from his home in Northern California. Now, my profound pleasure to introduce Gary Snyder. I've wanted Gary to read here for so long, and it's so moving to have him here for this particular evening. Gary is a poet, of course, author, scholar, cultural critic, and professor emeritus of UC Davis. He graduated from Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where his roommates were poets Lew Welch and Phil Whalen in 1951. And for the last 38 years, Gary has lived in the northern Sierra Nevada in the watershed of the South Yuba River. His work evinces, as one writer put it, a planetary and ecological cosmopolitanism. I love that phrase. He is the author of numerous books of poetry and prose. He's been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, as well as the Bollingen Poetry Prize. A line from his poem, Night Highway 99, to me pertains exactly to Gary. What elegance, what a life. Gary is going to read some of Lew's poems and some of his own, but first we're going to start tonight with hearing Lew's poems in his own voice, courtesy of the Penn Sound Archives, recorded at the Magic Lantern Cafe, April 22nd, 1967. Lew Welch in his own words. Thank you very much.
A circle, 100 feet round. Inside the circle are 300 things nobody understands and maybe nobody's ever really seen. How many can you find? Whenever I make a new poem, the old ones sound like gibberish. How can they ever make sense in a book? Let them say, he seems to have lived in the mountains. He traveled now and then. When he appeared in cities, he was almost always drunk. Most of his poems are lost. Many of those we have were found in letters to his friends. He had a very large number of friends. I burn up the deer in my body. I burn up the tree in my stove. I seldom let a carrot go to seed, and I grind up every kind of grain. How can I be and never be an inconvenience to others here, where only the vulture is absolutely pure, and in the Chicago River are carp. I saw myself a ring of bone in the clear stream of all of it, and vowed always to be open to it, that all of it might flow through, and then heard ring of bone, where ring is what a bell does.
I think this is my cue. That's Mount Tamalpais, about 30 years ago. Tom Killian, the artist, the woodblock artist who did that, and many others that we're going to see tonight, did sketches 30 years ago, 25 years ago, that he still works from, which is helpful because we can see what was there in slightly pre-modern times. And Tamil Pious, of course, is the signature mountain of the Northern Bay Area and the dominating feature in Marin County, California, the county which is just north of San Francisco across the Golden Gate, accessed now by the Golden Gate Bridge, and an area that will be referenced more than once the rest of this evening, because Lou Welch lived there, Lewis McAdams lived there, I've lived there, and it has been a place that we hark back to often. I first knew Lou when we were both undergraduates at Reed College in Portland, Oregon, in the 50s. And he was already, I guess, in his junior year when he transferred up from, what was that college down near Stockton? Pacific University, where he had a professor that he was very much influenced by, who, among other things, gosh, I didn't even tell this story when we were rehearsing, that Lou said that he would mix up a cold martini with ice and put it in a thermos at night and then whip up a salad with olive oil, and he would put the thermos martini and the salad under his bed before he went to sleep. And then when he got up in the morning, that's how he started the day. Lou was suitably impressed by that, and took it to be a sign of the way of the artist, which he explored much more later. I would just like to say that of the three of us, Lou Welch, Philip Whalen, and myself, young feckless poets in Oregon in the late 40s, early 50s, Lou was the most fetching. He was tall, handsome, clever, well-spoken, and we really admired and looked up to him for his great verbal skills. Phil Whalen, however, veteran of the Air Force on the GI Bill, was much better read. So he held forth, and we had to respect what he had to say without question. And he's the one who first introduced me to the Mahabharata, the Upanishads, to Sanskrit classics, because he had already roamed through those in his days in the Air Force when he didn't have much else to do except read Sanskrit texts. So, and another person who was there at the same time that I didn't quite appreciate until much later was another poet named William Dickey. Much more conservative, much more traditional, whatever that meant, in the 50s. Poet who ended up teaching most of his life at San Francisco State University, San Francisco State College. An admirable man and an admirable poet in his way, too. However, the triad of Philip, Lou, and myself, though nobody took us seriously when we were in college, but why should they? we learned a lot from each other. And one more person that I will, two more people that I'll invoke in this bit of background. One was Lou, one was Lloyd Reynolds, professor, instructor at Reed from the 30s on, who was a kind of a polymath, lover of William Blake, scholar of William Blake's poetry, but also a very fine calligrapher in the chancery, cursive, italic, cut your own turkey feather, grind your own ink mode. Really a wonderful teacher of calligraphy. Also a typographer, typesetter. So that when I did take my one course from Lloyd myself, it was not in calligraphy. I learned calligraphy from Philip and also from the Chinese-American veteran student and scholar Charlie Leong. What I learned from Lloyd was typography and how to set my own. He taught it. We had a creative writing class in which what mainly happened was you printed your own poem and then, you know, tried to convince yourself it was worth doing. And that was a wonderful experience. And let me just say another thing about that. Steve Jobs of Apple went to Reed College and was a dropout. Steve later, many years later, gave a commencement address at Stanford University, which was only a page and a half long, and which was circulated around. But in it, Steve Jobs gives credit to Lloyd Reynolds for giving him some consciousness of calligraphy and also of typography, and says that if the Apple Macintosh computer has a variety of fonts and has some pretty good fonts today, it's because of Lloyd Reynolds, which is quite a remarkable credit. And Jobs also went on to say, Microsoft and the others just copied us. So that is an interesting little ripple effect going out there, if true. Probably it is true. The last person that I was going to mention was Charlie Leong. He was born in Portland in the late 20s or early 30s, educated there by a very traditional Chinese family who sent him before the war to Beijing and where he apprenticed as a seal carver. For a while, and then came back to Portland, and then went into the army and fought in World War II. And when he was already in his 40s and still unmarried, a GI, he had the opportunity to take advantage of the GI Bill, and he did. He went to Reed, and he became the teacher. Like Phil Whalen was my teacher, the man who led me into and introduced me to Sanskrit. Texts, both Buddhist and Hindu. It was Charlie Leong who introduced us to Confucius and Zhuangzi and Laozi and taught us to be appreciative of Chinese calligraphy, just as Charlie himself had become a real expert at Roman alphabet chancery cursive calligraphy through the teachings of Lloyd Reynolds. If anyone doubts that, you can go to the Special Collections Library at the University of California in Davis and look at the archive of Charlie Leong's letters, and you'll see some of the best chancery cursive calligraphy you'll ever see. That's the truth. So Lou and I did a lot of things together. We backpacked up to Mount St. Helens. We hitchhiked here and there. And critiqued and laughed about each other's poetry for several years. And I'm going to read a few selections from the book called Ring of Bone, Collected Poems 1950 to 1971. Entire Sermon by the Red Monk. One, We Invent Ourselves, 1950. Everybody talks about inventing yourself now. We invent ourselves out of ingredients we didn't choose by a process we can't control. Three, the female impersonator and the sadistic marine can each trace himself back to the same stern or weak father. 4. Usually it's less dramatic. He was only indifferently a basketball player. Now he's selling cars. 5. The baby on the floor cannot be traced forward to anything. 6. It's all your own fault, then. 7. On all kinds of baby purpose, you invented whoever you think you are. Out of ingredients you couldn't choose by a process you can't control. All you really say is, love me for myself alone. Eight, it is also possible to uninvent yourself by a process you can't control. 9, but you invented Leo. He's talking to himself now. He calls himself Leo sometimes. But you invented Leo. Forget it. Notice that he does not use the word reinvent there. I don't think the word reinvented was invented yet. We have heard a few of the poems from a sequence called Hermit Poems already, although you didn't know that, but that's true. And there's a subsequent sequence called The Way Back. A little of the background here. Lou, after leaving Reed, went to the Midwest and ended up working for an advertising agency in Chicago. I knocked around in graduate school at Indiana University doing American Indian linguistics for a few months. I was so terrible at that that I quit and went out to the West Coast again and ended up studying classical Chinese in the East Asian Languages Department graduate school at Berkeley, where they had so few graduate students they would accept me. That's not kidding either. They said, well, are you going to go for the PhD? And I said, no, I just want to improve my education. And they shook their heads and said, that was Ed Schaefer, actually. He was the graduate advisor then, a great guy. Shook his head and said, we shouldn't admit you, but we're so short of students that we will. So I was able to study classical Chinese and Japanese reading and writing for several years at UC Berkeley while Lou was still in Chicago working away at other things. And then I went to Japan, and shortly after I went to Japan, the CIA started secretly giving money to departments that taught Chinese, and they had lots of graduate students after that. And so I got out just in time. While he was in Chicago, Lou scored big on one point. He was awarded a annual prize for the best advertising slogan of the year. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard this before. It's true. And the slogan was, Raid kills, bugs dead. That's a classic. They still use it. 4 monosyllables. It's a perfect little poem. And he doesn't even have his name on it. Reed kills bugs dead. However, you know, I had made it down to the Bay Area by this time, gotten out of Portland, gotten away from Indiana University, and I wrote Lou and said, you know, there's a lively poetry scene going on here. They have these interesting young poets, like a person named Allen Ginsberg and so forth, that are doing really nicely, and why don't you come out and join us? And that was all he needed to be told. He managed to get transferred and later quit completely out to the West Coast. And you know, that's where his story, that's when his story as a writer and as a poet and as an active member of the West Coast, Northern California West Coast initially, poetry scene really begins. He became fully engaged in that and got to know everybody. However, Lou always had a bit of a problem. Besides being too handsome and too smart, he also was a drinker. And he had a really hard time gradually, increasingly over the years with his alcohol. Stayed with me out in my cabin in Marin County for a spell where we had no glass in the windows, no electricity, and no heat. He's very good humored about that. But, he ended up driving taxi cab for quite a while and wrote some very nice poems about taxi cab driving, working as a taxi driver. But at a certain point, his life began to break up in new ways, and he went up to the Klamath River country, Klamath and the Trinity River country, and took on living alone in a cabin, you know, hoping to benefit from solitude and discipline for quite a while, and wrote a series of poems called the Hermit Poems, which are in this book, Ring of Bone. And at some point found himself done with that time, done with that work, and decided to go back down to the city, San Francisco. I'd like to read several of these poems because, for one thing, Lou evolved into a person of deep gratitude, of deep appreciation to the phenomenal world, which includes what we call nature. And it was quite sincere. He thanks his woodpile. He's leaving now. He's leaving to go back to San Francisco. The wood of the madrone burns with a flame at once lavender and mossy green, a color you sometimes see in a sari. Oak burns with a peppery smell. For a really hot fire, use bark. You can crack your stove with bark. All winter long, I make wood stews. Poem to stove to woodpile to stove to typewriter, woodpile, stove. And I can't stop peeking at it. Can't stop opening up the door. I can't stop giggling at it. Shack simple. That's a term up in the North Coast for people that have been living alone too long. They say, you're getting shack simple. Crazy as Han Shan, as Wittgenstein in his German hut, as all the others were and are, the ancient order of fire gigglers, who walked away finally from it, kicked the habit finally of self, of man-hooked man, which is not at last estrangement. He praises his canyons and peaks. Driving out to Callahan, you get the setting for it all. Cloud-shrouded gorges, foggy trees. I can't see the ridges anymore. River? A big Sung Dynasty landscape scroll, a mile high and longer than we'll ever know. He greets again the open road. Shut the shack door, packed the car, and drove to San Francisco. 400 miles through valleys of larks. The hills that year so green, a sheen of gold cast over them, as if the eye just couldn't stand such green. And not a single poppy, state flower, spookily gone. But I don't care in my survival car when, oh, my lady loves to ride with me. Hot whiskey, long concrete, back seat, rifle, food, and sleeping bag. Motionless, finally, just drifting along on concrete belt going 70 miles an hour underneath my car. Still, except for the swing of the steering wheel, and she, my lady, loves to sing to me. Anarchist lectures 5 hours long. Songs all winter wrong, set right. And I won't even let me stop to scribble them down. Hot whiskey, long concrete, big Chevy engine, six-ply song. How shrineless I pilgrim through the world. And the final poem in this little series is, he finally reaches the city. Woke up sick and cold in somebody else's bed, somewhere in the universe. To a glass of orange, to a glass of orange juice, a note. How she had to go to work and what, the phone and when. Gloria, XXX. Celsius, day, oh. Warm glass of water in the bathroom, strange towels, bottles, goo, ubiquitous. Crazy, razor, hopeless, lady, blades. I don't know who you are, but I'm going to shave you anyway, I said to myself. Diet pills in the medicine chest. Terrible vision of hyped-up ladies, much too skinny anyway, amphetamine suburb babble. Nowhere? Nowhere anymore that fat and lovely mother flesh to lay our heads upon. There, Louis. Nursely, almost unconcerned, as if her flesh were there to give rest to new flesh, thinner, growing, and sometimes scared. Kids, fidgety in the suburbs, the mothers, handsome. Check the milligrams, take the necessary dose, forward into the day. Damp towel about my loins, back to scented room, to orange juice, to miracle, 2 full inches left of vodka. Is this, then, the mystical return? The man come back? The Red Monk used to say, find yourself at some ridiculous task. Say, urinating in the hostess's flower bed. The party raging on above. And imagine all of your life and past lives till you see them vividly. Then, shaking off the dew, say out loud, so it has all come to this. On with the groovy boots, on with essential shades against the glare, remembering Lamantia's poem, blue grace behind dark glasses, steps out of 100 white cars all over town. How clean it looked that walked out the door. Ah, city, I would tell you how it was to stalk your streets so young, anonymous. There's a lot in that, not all of it quite wholesome. Oh, I know what that one is, yeah. He explains it another way. At times, we're almost able to see it was once all light and want to get back to it. Not brilliant, swift, or huge, since light is the measure and we are flakes off of the all-measure cinder cast off from the sun, explaining every fall and why we yearn so, harnessed jelly of the stars. As part of the poems from the Way Back sequence, one that I didn't read, but I'm going to read now, is called He Asks for Guidance. And this is really an interesting poem in its invocation of the Mahayana Buddhist Bodhisattva, the feminine force of Avalokiteshvara, or Guanyin, who is the speaker in the heart of the Prajnaparamita Wisdom Sutra series. So first I'm going to read his poem. Then I'm going to say the brief one page of Avalokiteshvara, heart of, which means core, of Transcendent Wisdom Sutra. I'll just recite it in English. And then I'll read a poem of mine which moves through the same territory, an interesting intersection of two different texts with the original text that was very close to the heart of what Lu was at his very best. He asks for guidance. Avalokiteshvara, Buddha of compassion, original bodhisattva, who spoke the Prajnaparamita Sutra of the heart. Kannon in Japan, Guanyin in China, Chenrezig in Tibet, no god, but guide, oh, countless thousands of returning men and women of every place and time, as Virgil for Dante, through Dante's hell, please guide me through samsara. Samsara being the word for the impermanent realm of ignorance that we tend to live in. So the sutra goes, brief sutra, it's a condensation of the big one. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, practicing deep Prajnaparamita, clearly saw five skandhas, empty, transforming all suffering and distress, saying, Shariputra, that was the listener, the monk who was listening, saying, Shariputra, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness exactly form. Sensation, thought, impulse, consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all things are marked by emptiness. Not born, not destroyed, not stained, not pure, without gain, without loss. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, sensation, thought, impulse, consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No color, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of thought. No realm of sight, no realm of thought. No ignorance, no ending of ignorance. No annihilation, no path, no wisdom, also no attainment. No attainment. Thus, no fear. All Buddhas, past, present, and future, live Prajnaparamita, and thus attain Anuttara, Samyak Sambodhi, highest perfect enlightenment. Therefore, know that Prajnaparamita is the great mantra, the unsurpassed mantra, the supreme mantra, that completely removes all suffering. This is truth, not deception. Therefore, put forth this Prajnaparamita mantra, saying, Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha, gone, gone, gone beyond, beyond, bodhisvaha, great wisdom, sutra. That's translated from the Sanskrit. Although there is a Tibetan and a Chinese and a Mongolian version of it too. And then here's the third text. The Kannon of Asakusa, Sensoji, Short Grass Temple, Sumida River. This is Tokyo, the only Buddhist temple worth mentioning almost left in Tokyo after World War II. Asakusa is a district of Tokyo down by the river, the Sumida, which is the river that flows from inland and out through Tokyo into Tokyo Bay and on out into the Pacific. At the Buddha Hall, of Sensoji, hundreds of worshippers surge up the high stone steps into the hall, dropping coins in the bin, and look into the black and gold chambers. Somewhere a statue of Kannon, Guan Yin, goddess of mercy, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Peace and compassion for all in this world realm, this particular time. Old and young people swirl by, incense in clouds. We follow the flow out the south side steps, white gravels, and back down the pilgrim stone walkway that leads there, lined with street stalls and shops, packed with babies in strollers, old folks in wheelchairs, girls in their tank tops. Go back to the gate at the entrance, the gold dragon mountain thunder gate, red tree pillars and sweeping tile eaves. Back out to the streets, traffic, police, taxis, the tempura restaurants of Edo. Cross to the riverside park space, men cross-legged on cardboard under the shade tree, and step into the long, slender riverboat water bus that runs down the Sumida River. I came here, unwitting, the right way, ascending the Sumidagawa, approaching Sensoji from the sea, under the Thunder Gate, walking the pilgrim path, climbing the steps to Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of compassion, asking, please guide us through samsara. Form, sensation, thought, impulse, consciousness are not born, not destroyed, without gain, without loss. Thus, no hindrance, thus, no fear. For all beings, living or not, beings or not, inside or outside of time. I've got one more Lew Welch poem, but I'm not going to read that till the end of the evening. And I'm going to finish now with one poem of my own recent poem that, if Lou were here, he would like it. It's called Stories in the Night. In Native California, the winter was storytelling time. Don't do any storytelling in the summertime. You're too busy anyway. Yesterday, I was working most of the day with a breakdown in the system. Generator 1, generator 2, old phased-out generator 3, the battery array, the big trace inverter, the solar panels, all had stopped. Cold early morning in the dark. Back to the old days. Kerosene lamp, candles. Wood stoves always work. The backup generator number 3 Honda cycles wrong, tricking the inverter relay that starts the bulk charge. The big green Onan, fueled by propane, wouldn't start. One time turned out there was a clogged air cleaner. Oil drops blow back up from deep inside. I try to remember machinery can always be fixed. But be ready to give up the plans that were made for the day. Go back to the manual. Call up friends who know more. Make some tea. Relax with your tools and your problems. Start enjoying the day. For 15 years we lived here. Kerosene lamps. Heavy tile roof in the shade of a huge pre-contact black oak. Cherry, Siegfried's longtime woman friend and partner, is due at any time with a 9-ton truck of 3/4-inch crushed rock. Wet dirt every winter eats up gravel. Keeping a few hard roads for drenching winter rains and melting snows takes planning. You have to ditch them, too. In 1962, going all through Kyushu with Joanne, walked around Hiroshima Bay, streets and coffee shops, green leafy trees and gardens, a lively place. But at Mount Aso, the great caldera in the center of the island, the crater 30 miles across, saw sightseers from Nagasaki with that twisted, shiny, scarred, burnt face of survivors from those days. And then I read Barefoot Gen, a graphic novel in two volumes with an English translation. What got me about the bomb was too much power, and then the temptations there to be the first to be the emperor of the world. Yet to be done. So change our course around or there we head. I could never be a Muslim, a Christian, or a Jew, because the Ten Commandments fall short of moral rigor. The Bible's shall not kill leaves out the other realms of life. How could that be? What sort of world did they think this is? With no account for all of the wriggling feelers and the little fins, the spines, the slimy necks, eyes shiny in the night, paw prints in the snow. And that other thing, can't have no other God before me, like profound anxiety of power and jealousy and envy. What sort of God is that? Worrying all the time. Plenty of little gods are waiting to begin their practice and learn just who they are. In North India, 4th century AD, some Buddhist tantric teacher lady said, "That god called Yahweh to the West, he's really something. But too bad. He has this nutty thing that he's creator of the world." A delusion that could really set you back. But returning to energy, I'll fix the Onan, I'll give up on number three, it's too far gone, and next time get a backup with a cast iron block and water cooling and a warranty good for centuries. Put in a bunch more panels for the sun. The old time people here in warm earth lodges 30 feet across burned pitchy pinewood slivers for their candles. Snow after snow for all those centuries before. Lodge fire light and pitchy slivers burning. Don't need much light for stories in the night. Thank you. More later. I forgot another one of my duties. I'm introducing Lewis McAdams to you now. Lewis McAdams is better known here than I am because he really lives here. And actually, longtime poet, longtime friend. He moved down here from Northern California in about 1980. Poet with a number of books in print. Scholar of jazz, the cool, society and its quirks. An artist and an activist in every sense. And also the man who discovered the Los Angeles River, which everybody had lost, forgotten where it was. Lewis is, I can't go on too well for all of the remarkable roles and accomplishments he's played. And he's not going to read from it tonight, but I am a big supporter of his latest book, which is called The River. So Lewis also was a friend and accomplice of Lew Welch's, and he's going to take over now.
Twenty-three or 24 years ago, the Friends of the Los Angeles River was merely a speck of sand in my eye. It only existed because I said it existed. And then Gary came down. He was giving a big reading at the old L.A. Theater Center on Spring Street. And he agreed to do a reading in our living room of poems about rivers. And we got enough money from that reading to get stationery made. And that very night, Gary read in a much, much larger reading at the theater center. And he said, I have just this afternoon been to the first meeting of Friends of the Los Angeles River. And everybody started laughing. And I remember Gary so well that night, holding up his finger going, don't laugh. So this is a thank you. That was just a thank you for Gary being at the center of the creation of that organization that I've been carrying around for the last 23 or 24 years. This is Lew Welch and, I mean, Gary and Lew were only two-thirds of an incredible triumvirate at Reed College. And the third person was a wonderful poet who became a Zen monk named Philip Whalen. And this is a poem of Lew Welch's called An Answer to a Question from P.W. In Mexico, I'll finish the novel I'll write rough while fire watching in Oregon. The problem is, what kind of typewriter to pack in? Ought to be able to live 6 months in Mexico and what I earn on the mountain in four. They say you can buy dirty books down there. Since they give you horses to pack things in, how would it be if I took in a big old typewriter and left it there? They don't give you horses to pack things out. Going to Mexico by motorcycle would be the coolest. But Thoreau warns against any undertaking that requires new clothes. Walking is pure, but I haven't achieved simplicity yet. I'll never willingly hitchhike again. Next winter, I can buy Snyder's Austin for $200. But how can I get the money together? They repossessed my Oldsmobile. I've never made the foreign country scene, like the sign over the urinal, you hold your future in your hand. Or what the giant black whore once said in the back of my cab, man, you sure do love digging at my titties. Now stop that. We get where we going, you can milk me like a Holstein, but I gotta see your money first. Just in case we were getting a little too serious here this evening. Reverential, even. In about 1968, I believe, there was a reading in San Francisco at a time when it was still, and probably still is really, the poetry capital of America. And it was a reading to benefit the San Francisco Ecology Center, which was just opening in a storefront in North Beach. And this reading, as far as I know, this was the first time I personally had, I believe, ever even heard the word ecology. And it's certainly, as far as I know, the first time I ever knew of a reading to benefit an organization that was promoting the idea of ecology. So I went to this reading, and it was a reading that included Gary, it included Lew Welch, it included Michael McClure, and I think it included Allen Ginsberg as well. And for that evening, I chose, as my medicine of choice, was mescaline. And I remember sitting up in the balcony and being stunned because Lew Welch seemed to be surrounded by gold. And after the reading, Gary and Lou and several other people came over to our commune on Potrero Hill. And Lou and I had a conversation that night that I've never forgotten. He was in his cups, to put it mildly, but he would move back and forth between utter coherence and a kind of attenuated incoherence. And he said that, and this was a great reading. It was the kind of reading that really San Francisco can only do. I remember that night, Michael, he was in his Hell's Angel phase at that point, and he rode his Harley onto the stage, you know, clad in complete leather in his sort of Jim Morrison look, and the Harley fell over on him. And it was that kind of, it was just a wild evening. And later that night, back at our place, Lou said to me, and I remember Gary sitting in the kitchen with a very sort of happy smile, but Lou didn't look happy at all. He was actually very unhappy, seemed on the verge of tears. And he talked to me for a bit, and he said that he had spent the entire day, that he had truly wanted to honor the occasion, this celebration, this early beginning celebration of the earth. And he had gone out spent the entire day on San Francisco Bay fishing and just being part of the tidal swells and the movement of the bay itself. And that was the kind of uncompromising approach how much he cared about his poems that stuck with me till this day. And I remember something else he wrote later that stuck with me equally as much when he said, "Guard the secrets, constantly reveal them." I lived for a long time in Bolinas, California, a small town in Northern California. And that's Mount Tamalpais that we've seen up here, and is the mountain that basically the whole county is part of. And Lou Welch wrote a poem called The Song Mount Tamalpais Sings. And he talked of the last place. And it was such an influential poem in the world that I was living in at that moment in Marin County that when the Marin County General Plan was released a couple of years later, they called it, for Lou's poem, "Can the Last Place Last?" And this is the song Mount Tamalpais sings. "This is the last place. There is nowhere else to go. Human movements, but for a few, are westerly. Man follows the sun. This is the last place. There is nowhere else to go. Or follows what he thinks to be the movement of the sun. It is hard to feel it as a rider on a spinning ball. This is the last place. There is nowhere else to go. Centuries and hordes of us from every quarter of the earth now piling up and each wave going back to get some more. This is the last place. There is nowhere else to go. My face is the map of the steppes," she said, "on this mountain looking west. My blood set singing by it to the old tunes, Irish still among these oaks. This is the last place. There is nowhere else to go. This is why, once again, we celebrate the great spring tides. Beaches are strewn again with jasper, agate, and jade. The mussel rock stands clear. This is the last place. There is nowhere else to go. This is why, once again, we celebrate the headland's huge, cairn-studded fall into the sea. This is the last place. There is nowhere else to go. For we have walked the jeweled beaches at the feet of the final cliffs of all man's wanderings. This is the last place. There is nowhere else we need to go." When Lou was in Chicago, he spent 5 years mostly depressed, working as a copywriter for Montgomery Ward, living in an unhappy relationship. And he basically spent that whole period struggling to create one poem, which became a poem of his farewell to the Windy City. And we're going to hear that poem right now.
Chicago poem. I lived here nearly 5 years before I could meet the Middle Western day with anything approaching dignity. It's a place that lets you understand the way the Bible is the way it is. Understand why the Bible is the way it is. Proud people cannot live here. The land's too flat, ugly, sullen, and big. It pounds men down past humbleness. They stoop at 35, possibly cringing from the heavy and terrible sky. In country like this, there can be no God but Yahweh. In the mills and refineries of its south side, Chicago passes its natural gas in flames, bouncing like Bunsens from stacks 100 feet high. The stench stabs at your eyeballs, the whole sky green and yellow backdrop for the skeleton steel of a bombed out town. Remember the movies in grammar school? The goggled men doing strong things in showers of steel spark. The dark screen cracking light and the furnace door opening with a blast of orange like a sunset or an orange. Well, it was photographed by a fairy, thrilled as a girl or a Nazi who hoped that there were people behind that door, hence the remote beauty. But Seavers, whose old man spent most of his life in there, remembers, he says, a nigger in a red T-shirt pissing into the black sand. It was 5 years until I could afford to recognize all this ferocity. Friends helped me. Then I put some love into my house. Finally, I found a farm where they let me shoot pheasant. Standing in the boat one night, I watched the lake go absolutely flat, smaller than raindrops, and only here and there the feeding rings of fish were visible 100 yards away, and the bluegill caught that afternoon lifted from its northern lake like a tropical jewel at its ear, belly gold so bright you'd swear he had a light in there. His color faded with his life, a small green fish. All things considered, it's a gentle and undemanding planet, even here. Certainly far gentler here than any of a dozen other places. The trouble is always and only with what we put on top of it. There's nobody else to blame. It does no good appealing to some ill-invented thunderer brooding above some unimaginable crag. You can't fix it, and you can't make it go away, and never forget it is ours. Right down to the last small hinge, it all depends for its existence. Only and utterly upon our sufferance. Driving back, I saw Chicago rising in its gases, and I knew again that never will a man be made to stand against this pitiless, unparalleled monstrosity that snuffles on the beach of its great lake like a blind red rhinoceros. It's already running us down. You can't fix it. You can't make it go away. I don't know what you're going to do about it, but I know what I'm going to do about it. I'm just going to walk away from it. Maybe a small part of it will die if I'm not around feeding it anymore.
I guess apologies are due to all Chicagoans in the audience. I'm going to take you back to 1971 in Portland, Oregon. I was a sophomore at Reed College with my boyfriend living in a little house in Southeast, and we were both great fans of Lew Welch. We'd read his poetry out loud at night, and we heard that Lew Welch was going to be the poet in residence at Reed College, and we were thrilled, and we asked the committee who invited him, could we make dinner for him, and they went, hell, you can have him for the whole week. So we became the hosts of Lew Welch, and I later learned that the committee had originally invited Gary, and Gary couldn't come, and Gary had suggested asking Phil Whalen, and Phil Whalen couldn't come, and he had suggested asking Lew, and Lew was thrilled to come, and I don't think he knew this background, but we were thrilled to have him. So we cooked, and we shopped, and we cleaned our little house, and we got great groceries from Corno's grocery store, and we baked Tibetan barley bread, and we made a blackberry pie with fresh-picked blackberries, and we waited for our revered poet to come to our door. And there was a knock on the door at about 6 o'clock, and there was this man there with a stubble of beard and a lumpy overcoat, you know, smelling of Jim Beam, and that was Lew Welch, and our imperfect Zen master, and we were in his thrall all week. It was an amazing week. He never ate anything we prepared. Orange juice with raw egg in the morning. He called it some hair of the dog. That seemed to be it. But he was very touched by our domesticity, and I think he was honestly curious what life would bring to us. We were, to him, so privileged, these aspiring poets to be. And we admired him just enormously for all he had done. He'd hitchhiked across the country with Kerouac. He was one of the original Beats. He'd written Raid Kills Bugs Dead. He'd done a short stint as an advertising copywriter. And the road he had chosen as an authentic poet, a longshoreman, and an alcoholic was a hard one. He taught us about poetry as speech and speech as poetry. My finger on the throttle and my foot upon the pedal of the clutch. We loved to hear him speak. He came and spoke to my American literature class later that spring. He came to dry out, so to speak, at a stump farm owned by the wonderful Bill Yardas, who had been his fishing partner in the Bay Area. Bill's son is here in the audience tonight, and Dan and I would often go up to the Yardas farm and listen to Bill and Lew chat and trade stories, you know, in clouds of dope and tobacco smoke way into the night, and it was really fascinating. When he did come to visit us that first week in Portland, there was a rare heavy snow. And since Lew had been a taxi driver and he loved driving taxi, he insisted on taking us everywhere by taxi. And, you know, we were students, you know, it was only a half a mile to campus, but he insisted, you know, since he was the poet in residence, that we were going to be chauffeured. So it was our first look at Southeast Portland through the windows of a yellow cab as it churned its way through the unplowed streets. And I thought I would read to you from a suite of poems called Taxi Suite, a beautiful poem called After Anacreon. And Anacreon was a Greek poet known for love poems and drinking songs. So this is After Anacreon. When I drive cab, I am moved by strange whistles and wear a hat. When I drive cab, I am the hunter. My prey leaps up from where it hid, beguiling me with gestures. When I drive cab, all may command me, yet I am in command of all who do. When I drive cab, I am guided by voices descending from the naked air. When I drive cab, a revelation of movement comes to me. They wake now. Now they want to work or look around. Now they want drunkenness and heavy food. Now they contrive to love. When I drive cab, I bring the sailor home from the sea. In the back of my car, he fingers the pelt of his maiden. When I drive cab, I watch for stragglers in the urban order of things. When I drive cab, I end the only lit and waitful thing in miles of darkened houses. That summer, after Lou came up to Bill Yardis's place, we had all decided he was going to build a cabin on land owned by Allen Ginsberg next to Gary's, and Dan and I were going to be part of the crew. I was going to be the camp cook. Lou was no student of feminism. And there were a few other students who were going to come. He wrote us letters outlining our duties. We were supposed to show up in early August when the building materials would have arrived. And I remember that he was very worried about the financial outlay, and he was worried about running the show and how was this cabin going to get built. But it was such a chance for him to make this new life. Before we went up to Northern California, I flew home to Culver City, where my parents lived. And I remember the morning, my first morning home, picking up the LA Times, and there was this bolded headline that said, "Search off for missing Beat Generation poet." And my heart lurched, and this little brief article described how the poet Lou Welch had been missing for a week in the Sierra foothills. On May 23rd, it said, apparently in a deep depression, Welch took his revolver and walked away into the forest. His body has never been found. So I guess I feel like I'm still searching for Lou, even though I don't think he would have chosen to disappear into urban America. I know that he's still here in his poetry. And here's one poem that was kind of foreshadowed by that Gary read that I recommend to all of you. And it really comes in handy, so you may want to tape it to your wall in these times. It's called "A Small Sentence to Drive Yourself Sane." The next time you are doing something absolutely ordinary, or even better, the next time you're doing something absolutely necessary, such as pissing, or making love, or shaving, or washing the dishes, or the baby, or yourself, or the room, say to yourself, "So it's all come to this." And in another way, this night, it's all come to this, I say to April, whom I wanted to introduce next. April Fitzsimmons was a member of the Veterans Writing Workshop here at the Los Angeles Public Library, which I led for a couple of years, and which was a marvelous experience. She's an Air Force vet, and one day she brought in this paper that she had written for Antioch called 300 Things About Lou Welch, and I went, "Lou Welch." So we found we had this in common, and it's been a marvelous bond, and I think we started envisioning this, dreaming of a night like this, and It's a marvelous thing to have you here to join us for it, and please welcome April Fitzsimmons.
Thanks. Thanks, everybody, for coming tonight. It was so exciting to me that this actually manifested. You know, I stumbled upon Lou Welch when I was working this cubicle desk job, and I was Googling suicidal poets. And, you know, and he wasn't really suicidal, he was missing, so he was like a question mark, sort of a disappearer, which was even more mysterious. And, you know, I was really titillated by that for a long time, but when I started to get into his poetry, you know, the romance of this disappeared, possibly, probably dead man started to wear off, and his poetry started to really influence me. And I think the thing that I've discovered, and I hope you check out this one little book that exists, is the vulnerability that he puts forward, not only in his work, the simplicity and the vulnerability, but also in his letters, this two book of letters called I Remain, where he just bares his soul, and he struggled with alcohol his whole life. He had 5 nervous breakdowns in 44 years, and the 6th one was the one that took him out. So he really desperately tried to live as a poet and a human being in this world, and I just found it a very noble struggle. And then I got to meet amazing people who also, you know, knew him and celebrated him. One of my favorite ways to look for enlightenment is one of his littler special poems called Difficulty Along the Way. difficulty along the way. Seeking perfect total enlightenment is looking for a flashlight when all you need the flashlight for is to find your flashlight. You know, and the other thing Lou played around a lot with, which was a professional education. You know, he went to University of Chicago there for a long time studying linguistics, and he was fascinated by language and how we say what we say and how it's communicated to people through our voice. And he was really a spoken word poet and you know, would have loved all the spoken word forums that there are today. But as he got around to preparing his work, he decided that he had his own idea for college. And he actually created his own curriculum called courses. And so, you know, if you've ever been shy about advancing your education, tonight's the night. You're all going to be enrolled in the school. I hope that's okay. There's just one college credo, and that is, we refuse the right to serve anybody. He starts it out, courses, no credit, no blame, no balm. So you can take your own private oath. Here's the college oath. It's already been spoken tonight, so it's quite popular. You can say it to yourself. I don't want to embarrass you. All persecutors shall be violated. And here are the classes. Geography. The Far East is west of us, nearer by far than the Near East, and mysteriouser. Is the Middle East really the Middle West? And there aren't seven continents, there are six. Europe and Asia are stuck together in the middle. History. Every 30 years or so, elders arm children with expensive weapons and send them away to kill other children similarly armed. You got that? Some do not return. Some return maimed or terrified into madness. Many come back brutal. Nothing else changes. Mr. Krupp got the whole works back by producing a single document from his briefcase. Aesthetics. Not very many can do it really well. Nobody knows why. Mathematics. One and one makes two. There is a two which is one at last. One alone is lonely. Three is possible. There are plenty of holes for everybody. Four is nearly impossible. Try it. A great mathematician, and this is a true story, while waiting in a brothel and looking at dirty pictures, suddenly got the vision of all the combinations of all the plugs and holes of nine. Excited, he ran home and invented our theorems and combinations and permutations. That day, he didn't get laid. Theology. The true rebel never advertises it. He prefers his joy to missionary work. Church is bureaucracy, no more interesting than any post office. Religion is revelation, all the wonder of all the planets striking all your only mind. Guard the mysteries, constantly reveal them. Bang. Psychology. The trouble is, most people spend their lives living it down. That's a slow one. Okay. Botany. Consider the passion flower. Are you all considering it? Botany. Consider the passion flower. Who'd ever think a plant would go to so much trouble just to get fucked by a bee? Philosophy. Never ask why what. Always ask what's what. Observe, connect, and do. The great wine master is almost a magician to the bulk of his tribe. To his peers, he is only accurate. He knows the grapes so well, they say. He turned into a vine. Now, there's only one course in this class that's required, and this is it. And it's called the Basic Con. Those who can't find anything to live for always invent something to die for. And then they want the rest of us to die for it too. These and an elite army of thousands who do nobody any good at all, but do great harm to some, have always collected vast sums from all. Finally, all this machinery tries to kill us, because we won't die for it too. And now you're graduating, and this is the graduation address. Course, college, graduation address. Number one, freak out. Number two, come back. Number three, bandage the wounded and feed however many you can. Number four, never cheat. And that's the conclusion of our college class. You're graduated. Congratulations. So I just want to reintroduce Gary Snyder to read this last poem. And what I want to share with you about this book is it didn't happen when Lou was living. You know, Lou tried his whole life to get a whole book of poetry published. And he did order the poems in this book. He had it ready. So someone didn't come in and rearrange the poems after he had died. Don Allen had agreed to publish this book, and Grove Press tried to publish it, and it didn't happen before he died. So after he died, it did happen. But the poem that Gary's about to read, The Song of the Turkey Buzzard, is the last poem in his book. And he knew it would be the last poem. And I just wanted you to know that about the placement of this particular poem in terms of his life and his legacy. Gary Snyder.
Before I read The Song of the Turkey Buzzard, I'm going to read a couple of short poems that I wrote over the years for Lou. This is called Four from Lou. Came to me one afternoon in the sauna where you get kind of spacey because of the heat, and I had been in there for a while. Lou Welch just turned up one day. Live as you and me. Damn, Lou, I said. You didn't shoot yourself after all. Yes, I did, he said. And even then, I felt the tingling down my back. Yes, you did too, I said. I can feel it now. Yeah, he said. There's a basic fear between your world and mine. I don't know why. But what I came to say was, teach the children about the cycles, the life cycles, all the other cycles. That's what it's all about, and it's all for God. For Lou Welch, in a snowfall, March of 1991. A snowfall in March, I sit in the white glow reading a thesis about you, your poems, your life. The author is my student. He even quotes me. 40 years since we joked in a kitchen in Portland, 20 since you disappeared. All those years and their moments, crackling bacon, slamming car doors, poems tried out on friends, will be one more archive, one more shaky text. But life continues in the kitchen, where we still laugh and cook, watching snow. Song of the Turkey Buzzard. Praises, Tamil Pious, perfect in wisdom and beauty, she of the wheeling birds. The writer riddle is easy to ask, but the answer might surprise you. How desperately I wanted cougar, I, calling myself Leo, etc., with brilliant proofs, terrain, color, food, all nonsense, all made up. I wanted cougar to be the being that I rode. But they were always there, the laziest high flyers, bronze-winged, the silent ones. A cunning man always laughs and smiles, even if he is desperately hungry, while a good bird always flies like a vulture, even if he is starving, Milarepa sang. Over and over again, that sign. I hit one once with a .22, heard the flack, and the feathers flew off. He flapped his wings just once and then went on sailing. Bronze, when seen from above, as I have seen them all day, sitting on a cliff so steep that they circled below me in the updraft. Passed so close I could see the eyes. Praises, Tamil Pious, perfect in wisdom and beauty, she of the wheeling birds. Another time the vision was so clear that another saw it too. Wet, a hatching bird, the shell of the egg streaked with dry scum, exhausted, wet, too weak to move, shriveled wings, fierce sun heat, sand, twitching as with elbows. We all have the same parts, beak open, neck stretched out, gasping for air. Oh, how we want to live. Poor little bird, she said. He'll never make it. Praises, Tamil Pious, perfect in wisdom and beauty, she of the wheeling birds. Even so, I didn't get it for a long time. It finally came in a trance, a coma, half in sleep, half in fever mind. A turkey buzzard, wounded, found by a rock on the mountain. He wanted to die alone. I had never seen one wild so close. When I reached out, he sidled away, head drooping, as dizzy as I was. I put my hands on his wing shoulders and lifted him. He tried feebly to tear at my hands with his beak. He tore my flesh too slightly to make any difference. Then he tried to heave his great wings. Weak as he was, I could barely hold him. A drunken veterinarian found a festering bullet in his side, a .22 that slid between the great bronze scales his feathers were. We removed it and cleansed the wound. Finally, he ate rotten gophers I trapped and prepared for him. Even at first, he drank a lot of water. My dog seemed frightened of him. They smell sweet. Meat is dry on their talons. The very opposite of death. Bird of rebirth, buzzard. Meat is rotten meat made sweet again and lean, unkillable, wing-locked, sorer, but he's till he's but a speck in the highest sky, infallible, eye finds feast on baked concrete, free. A squashed rabbit ripened like good cheese to keep the highways clean and bother no being. Part 2. Praises. Gentle Tamalpais, perfect in wisdom and beauty, of the sweetest water and the soaring birds, great seas at the feet of thy cliffs. Hear my last will and testament. Among my friends there shall always be one with proper instructions for my continuance. Let no one grieve. I shall have used it all up, used up every bit of it. What an extravagance. What a relief. On a marked rock, following his orders, place my meat. All care must be taken not to frighten the natives of this barbarous land, who will not let us die, even as we wish. With proper ceremony, disembowel what I no longer need, that I might more quickly rot and tempt my new form. Not the bronze casket, but the brazen wing, soaring forever above thee, O perfect, O sweetest water, O glorious, wheeling.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.